In Iraq, a bad deja vu. Today, Wednesday, June 11th, it's The World. I'm Marco Werman. Almost 500,000 Iraqis flee the city of Mosul after it falls to militants.
Many people were traveling in cars. You could see people even sitting in car trunks, especially the roads near to Mosul.
The city's now mostly in the hands of a militant group called ISIS, and some are asking how it managed its assault on Mosul.
The problem here is not how ISIS managed to take over Mosul, but how the Iraqi army managed to collapse so quickly.
Also, cabbies across Europe go on strike to protest the online car service Uber, and later, beards are back. And by that I mean back in the political crosshairs, but it's hardly the first time.
Facial hair was considered filthy, so men were told to discard their beard.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, celebrating people living with medical technology who are giving back to their communities. Apply for the Bakken Invitation Award and earn a $20,000 charitable grant for your charity. Learn more at liveongiveon.org.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. I never thought we'd start an edition of The World with a traffic report, but just so happens there's a lot of traffic in the news today. In Brazil, where anti-World Cup protesters keep blocking roads with the tournament starting tomorrow. And in London, where cab drivers today clogged Trafalgar Square to protest the online car service Uber. We'll tell you about those go slows a bit later, but first to a traffic jam of a different and very worrying kind. Almost 500,000 people piled into vehicles and fleeing their homes in Mosul. That's a city in northern Iraq, where insurgents are now largely in control. In fact, in the last 24 hours, al-Qaeda-inspired militants have seized large portions of Iraq north of Baghdad, towns where thousands of Americans once fought, like Tikrit, Baiji, and Samarra, are now in the hands of the militants. The Iraqi army has reportedly melted away in many places without putting up much resistance. The Iraqi government is asking for help, saying it faces a mortal danger. Earlier today, I spoke with Aram Shakaram. He's the acting country director in Iraq for Save the Children. He's just arrived in Erbil, a city in northern Iraq, where he says he found many people who'd fled Mosul.
What we are seeing is thousands of families fleeing from Mosul, and hundreds of thousands are thought to be on the run as well, but they have not yet made to the borders of Kurdistan region yet.
Well, I've seen some pictures of traffic jams that are just unreal. Can you tell us what this kind of flight from a city like Mosul looks like?
It is really a big crisis for the people out there. Many people were traveling in cars. You could see people even sitting in car trunks, especially the roads near to Mosul.
And they're sitting in car trunks because cars are trying to get as many people in as
possible. Exactly, as many people as possible, yeah.
Do you have an actual count, an approximate number of refugees who have arrived in the last 48 hours?
Hard to tell. The local authorities are preparing to have camps for 300,000 arriving in the next days. It's estimated nearly 500,000 people are on a move.
Right. And of those 500,000, are they on foot?
Only those who had cars have made it to the borders of Kurdistan region. But those who have been walking, we still to see and establish the picture.
Mr. Shakaram, did you have any idea that this was about to happen?
Never. This scale of displacement was not expected. So unless international community responds immediately, it is going to be beyond the capacities.
I've seen some reports about soldiers in Mosul just throwing down their arms and fleeing. I don't know if you've heard those reports, but are you at all concerned that after Fallujah and Mosul, are you concerned that Erbil might be the next target?
It could be, but here security forces are on alert, and what we are hearing is most reassurance that this place will be safe.
Aram Shakaram, Save the Children's acting country director in Iraq. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me.
The militant group that's driving the chaos in northern Iraq calls itself the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, ISIS, or ISIL for short. The group draws support from Iraq's Sunni population, but as they head south towards Baghdad, the population becomes more Shiite. Suad Al-Sali reports from Baghdad for the New York Times. I asked her earlier today what the mood was there.
People are really worried. They are calm, but they are worried at the same time. And just they started paying more food material, more fuel.
More fuel. Yeah.
Some of them fuel for the generators and the cars. Instead, they were going to need it.
So stockpiling men, basic essentials.
Exactly, and the young men looking now to pay light weapons because they believe that the troops are incapable to protect their families, so they are looking to protect themselves.
So, Sudad, is the Iraqi state in danger right now?
They are unstable, but I don't know if they are in danger or not, because until the militants reached Samarra, everything will mean that they used to deal with Sunni areas. Then, after Samarra, they have to deal with Shiites, okay? So we are expecting fierce battles will be there in northern Baghdad, starting from Samarra on the northern areas of Baghdad. I think the Iraqi government is really relying or betting on Shiites to fight, to protect themselves.
And do you think that's a safe bet for them to make?
Yeah.
You think the Shia will come to the Iraqi government's aid and help them fight?
No, they don't care about the government. They care about themselves. They are looking to protect themselves. They believe that the government is weak and they have to back it up to what they said to support their sect. It's not about the government. It is not about Maliki anymore. It's about the sect, Shia sect.
Couldn't that lead to a brutal civilian sectarian war?
This is expected. This is widely expected. It will come to be Shiite-Sunni battle, for sure.
How do people feel about that?
They're scared. They are scared, but still calm.
Sudad Al-Sali, reporting from Baghdad for The New York Times. Thank you.
Pleasure. You are welcome.
Gaith Abdulahad of Britain's Guardian newspaper is following events in Iraq from neighboring Turkey. Do you share the opinion, Gaith, that we just heard from Sudad Al-Sali in Baghdad, that we're facing possibly a full-on sectarian war in Iraq?
I think we are, actually. The closer the rebels come to Baghdad, they will be hitting the mixed Sunni Shia areas. And the Shia militias are moving north. They will try to protect the shrines in Samarra. They will try to protect Baghdad, actually. And that is your recipe of civil war.
I mean, I'm baffled. I'm sure our listeners are baffled just how we got here. I mean, tens of thousands of heavily armed Iraqi troops in the north just yesterday. And suddenly they've disappeared. What happened? Where did they go?
Marco, the Iraqi army is a corrupt institution. Every soldier gets his position by paying a bribe. Every officer, if not a political appointee, will get his position by paying a bribe. At the same time, when they're faced with real battle, they will defect. I've been talking to army officers who were part of the battle in Ramadi, and they told me the biggest problem they have is the desertion. If you're paying a bribe to go into to get a job, basically, to be paid $1,000 a month, why would you fight? Why would you risk your life? You will defect. And that is the issue.
So how far back did this corruption go? Before the Americans left or since the Americans have departed Iraq?
The problem goes back to during the American days. The Iraqi army was never created as a national army. A lot of the officers were former members of the Shia militia. The former Iraqi army was disbanded. They created a new army in the midst of civil war. And it is a very sectarian army. You know, I went to Ramadi a few months ago during the fighting, and all the units of the Iraqi army carried sectarian banners, Shia flags, Shia posters, so for an average Sunni, he would look into this army and he wouldn't see an Iraqi national army, but a sort of an occupation army, a Shia army.
So the Iraqi army has now not just lost personnel and people, but also heavy weapons and vehicles. Have you been counting how many?
Well, that's a huge thing. I mean, I think they've managed to sustain themselves for the past 2 years based on the meager amount of weapons that they've managed to capture from the Syrian army. Now, this is highly more sophisticated weapons, most of it American weapons. People are speaking of 20 tanks, 2 helicopters, hundreds of Humvees. This will move ISIS from a local insurgency, from a militia, into an army-grade institution. This is the biggest issue here, is all the weapons that they've captured.
Gaith, you're in Turkey, as I said, and there are a bunch of Turkish officials who have been seized by the jihadis, and Turkey has actually called an emergency meeting of NATO to discuss the crisis in Iraq. Do you think outside powers could get involved? Could the United States get re-involved?
Probably they will at one point, at least to kind of protect the Kurdish region and the oil supplies. To be honest with you, I don't see how ISIS would be defeated without outside intervention now. That in itself will create a whole set of problems. But we are talking about the collapse of an institution that has cost billions of U.S. taxpayer money. Will the Americans be willing to go back and fight in the streets of Baghdad? I don't know. I mean, I can't see that.
Gaith Abdulahad with Britain's Guardian newspaper. Good to speak with you again. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
As I mentioned earlier, ISIS stands for the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. The World's Matthew Bell has more now on who these militants are and what they want.
In this recent video from Mosul in northern Iraq, a guy in a mask, camouflage baseball cap, and an assault rifle holds forth. He's standing in front of a disabled Iraqi armored vehicle, and he says the city is now under the control of ISIS, thanks be to God. And Maliki, the Iraqi prime minister, he says, will burn in hell. Fighters with ISIS have been active in Syria for some time, and they've earned a reputation for brutality. But the group's decisive rout of Iraqi security forces in recent days has been astounding, says Bill Raggio. He's the editor of the Long War Journal. Raggio says ISIS was born out of the group Al-Qaeda in Iraq, the same one that U.S. forces fought for years. In Syria, ISIS had a disagreement over strategy, and it was disowned by the core leadership of Al-Qaeda. But Raggio says the two groups have a similar ideology.
They are a jihadist group just like Al-Qaeda. They seek to impose an Islamic caliphate and impose their harsh version of Sharia law or Islamic law. And they want to do it throughout the region.
ISIS is one of many non-state actors in a troubled region, but Raggio says, unlike most jihadi extremist groups, ISIS actually controls a huge swath of territory.
The Syrian security forces are unable to eject ISIS since 2011, 2012, and the Iraqis haven't been able to do it in Anbar province for the last 6 months. So yeah, at some point, they are the state. They have their caliphate or the nucleus of their caliphate, and they're not going to stop.
The commander of ISIS is Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. There's a $10 million U.S. reward on his head, but not much is known about him. In Iraq, Bill Raggio says Baghdadi and his ISIS fighters appear to be following the same grand plan that their al-Qaeda predecessors did.
Basically, the plan is you start surrounding Baghdad. You take these key areas around Baghdad, you deny them, and then you take control of the provinces. They basically rip this plan back off the shelf. And they're putting it into effect. I think we're going to, at some point, see some form of siege on Baghdad.
Raggio says ISIS might be overextending itself militarily, but so far the Iraqi security forces have proven to be woefully ineffective in stopping the group's advance.
The Iraqi security forces are going to have a very difficult time clearing and holding ISIS from these areas without the help of the Kurds and other powers.
In that video from Mosul, armed, masked men are seen climbing into abandoned Iraqi police vehicles and driving away as other men stand by shooting videos with their phones and tablets. It very much leaves the impression that ISIS is on the move, and U.S. officials have been saying as much. In Washington today, the man nominated to be U.S. ambassador to Iraq called ISIS one of the most dangerous terrorist groups in the world. Stuart Jones told lawmakers, "The Obama administration is watching events in Iraq closely and will work with partners to help those fleeing the fighting." For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
You're tuned to The World on PRI, Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI and supported by TiVo, able to search cable TV, on-demand libraries, and streaming content from Netflix and Hulu Plus on a single screen, available at TiVo.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. If you need a car and a driver to take you from point A to point B, you can flag a taxicab, or in many places, if you've got a smartphone, you can grab Uber. For the uninitiated, that's an app from a San Francisco-based company that connects you with a private car and driver who sign up to take you where you need to go. Uber is not universally loved. Let's say that. Cab drivers around the world have a big problem with the company. And today, cabbies from Berlin to London protested against apps like Uber by blocking some main roadways. The cabbies are upset that Uber drivers are not subject to the same regulations that govern licensed taxis. Lewis Norton is a cabbie in London and is branch secretary for the RMT Transport Union there. He spoke to me earlier from a protest in Trafalgar Square, where scores of London's iconic black taxis block traffic.
There's like zero movement of traffic in solid black cabs, as far as the eye can see, from the Trafalgar Square down to Big Ben at the moment.
So what are the reasons for this protest?
The reason for this protest is that Transport for London, our licensing body, refused to enforce the law, specifically the 1998 London Private Hire Vehicles Act, which Uber, Circumvent are in direct contravention of.
And you believe that Uber, this online transportation service, is violating that law?
It's absolutely violating. They use a device to replicate a taxi meter, which is forbidden in the 1998 Private Hire Vehicles Act. And the only vehicle that should have any sort of device that calculates fares and distance elapsed should be a taxi, a licensed London taxi.
Don't the black cabs, the classic black cabs like the ones you drive, Mr. Norton, aren't they kind of essentially a monopoly? And don't you see Uber is trying to break that monopoly?
Well, I completely disagree with that. The black cab is not a monopoly, and it's not a private company. The black cab is essentially public transport, along with the tube and the buses. What Uber do, Uber are a private company. Uber, in essential, could have a monopoly in the future because they are a very strong, strongly funded organisation. They eventually... They operate in the free market. The black cabs do not. Black cabs form part of public transport. And what it is that our rights to fly for hire, given the knowledge of London, the rights that we earn are basically being circumvented and given to someone who could essentially have an application and drive.
Now, you just referred to the knowledge of London. That's actually a very key part of driving a taxi in London. That's part of the test. Explain what the knowledge is.
The knowledge of London requires candidates who wish to become taxi drivers to learn over 320 runs, which encompasses 25,000 points of interest and over 5,000 streets. Now, until someone's completed that test, they're not obliged or not allowed to drive a licensed taxi.
Right. I mean, that's fair, it seems. I mean, you have to know these streets. But these days with GPS, do you really need to know the streets?
Well, yeah, I believe GPS is still not as efficient as the human brain. But what also the knowledge is, it's not just essentially about learning roads. It's about determining whether the driver is of good, fit and proper character. Because the nature of the black taxi can be publicly hired, that means any person, any individual from any background can hire me publicly on the street and I'm obliged to take them within 6 miles radius of Charing Cross. People know that we are a safe, essential service to get them from A to B.
I mean, you're suggesting that there are some rigors to becoming a taxi driver in the black cab business in London, but I hear a lot of people who get into the black cab business driving those classic black cabs. It's basically a white men's club, first of all, say a lot of the critics. Do you agree that it is a tough business to enter?
Unequivocally, no, it's not a white man's club. That is a very, if I'll be honest with you, that's a very age-old, maybe 30-year-old stereotype which they adhere to. Now, the thing is, the black cab, the knowledge of London, is open to anyone, man, woman, black, white. Now, it's a fair system. If you want to put your time in for 3 years to learn it, you can become a licensed taxi.
And considering how chock-a-block it is down there by Whitehall with all those black cabs, how are you going to get out of there? You're not going to be able to get out of there till midnight.
I'll be honest with you, the Metropolitan Police are very efficient when they want to clear you. And this is the issue, an absolute irony. We're here today protesting about the law not being upheld, yet when the Metropolitan Police and Transport for London want to uphold the law to obviously quash any of our democratic rights to protest, to be sure they will definitely clear this protest within about 20 minutes.
London black cab driver Lewis Norton, who is also the branch secretary for the Labour Union in London with transportation workers. Thank you very much, Lewis.
Thank you very much.
You can see photos of the protesting cab drivers in London and throughout Europe at PRI.org. Now, if you're planning a trip to London, make sure you pack the bug spray. A new study has found that cities in the UK are becoming friendlier places for mosquitoes, and not just any mosquitoes, but a couple of especially worrisome kinds of mosquito. Russell Newlove has our story from the British capital.
London is in the middle of an unprecedented construction boom, with new skyscrapers sprouting up almost by the day. But parts of the city and the surrounding area are also filling up with a new feature that's a lot smaller.
So here we have a couple of our water butts. We've got them scattered all over this area.
That's Amanda Callahan, a zoologist at the University of Reading, and waterbutt is local lingo for rain barrel. When Britain went through a drought in 2012, sales of rain barrels rose here. Problem is, the waterbutts weren't the only thing to increase.
Can you see immediately these little animals wriggling?
Callahan pulls the lid off a trash can filled with water. Pretty much the same thing as a rain barrel.
Those are the mosquito larvae, which are called wrigglers.
The waterbutts frequently have holes in their lids, and this allows mosquitoes to get inside and breed.
Callahan says that's a problem in urban environments because cities are generally warmer than the countryside, so they're already a better home for some mosquitoes. She's been studying the behaviour of mosquitoes across Britain as climate change slowly increases temperatures here. And she says the higher urban temperatures, together with abundant predator-free habitats like barrels full of rainwater, contributed to an unexpected and troubling result.
In the urban environments, you had fewer species, but the species that were there were more abundant. And what's interesting is that both of those species transmit diseases in other countries.
Diseases like malaria.
And if somebody did have malaria, it's an ideal situation in which to transmit diseases.
Callahan's research has raised eyebrows here because it hints at a nightmare climate change scenario that many public health officials have warned about. Tropical diseases like malaria working their way into places like London where they could never survive before. But there's a difference between mosquitoes that can carry malaria and ones that do carry it. That's why other British public health researchers aren't ringing the alarm.
The cases of malaria we see in the UK are imported. It's not naturally transmitted in Britain.
Peter Chiodini is England's go-to guy for malaria advice. He's director of the Public Health England Malaria Reference Laboratory. He says any outbreak would be of secondary malaria. That's when an infected person is bitten by a mosquito and the same mosquito then bites someone else. Not unheard of, but
the chances of that happening and leading to malaria becoming established in the UK are extremely remote.
Chiodini believes the UK's sophisticated public health system could spot and treat any unexpected cases of malaria that might come from all those new bugs in London's urban jungle before they turn into an outbreak. So maybe put that nightmare scenario back to bed, at least for now. But researcher Amanda Callahan says it's important just to know that the mosquitoes are there.
Because if you do suddenly get a disease outbreak, you want to know where the mosquitoes are breeding.
As for those new waterbutts, both researchers say there's no need for Londoners to get rid of them, unless they hate mosquito bites more than they like conserving water. For The World, I'm Russell Newlove in London.
I'm Marco Werman. Ahead, does that Tea Party win in a Virginia primary spell doom for immigration reform? Not for this activist.
Failure to fix immigration reform is not an option.
Plus, why we call it soccer while everyone else says football, and why beards sometimes raise a political ruckus. Those stories and more coming up on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, celebrating people living with medical technology who are giving back to their communities. Apply for the Bakken Invitation Award and earn a $20,000 charitable grant for your charity. Learn more at liveongiveon.org.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. And we're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, WGBH Boston. We were talking earlier in the program about the training the Iraqi army received from the U.S., the same Iraqi army whose members now appear to be deserting in droves. Let's shift our focus now to Libya. Since the 2011 revolution there, there's been no Libyan army, just militias. But right now, Libyan soldiers are being trained to form a new force. And that training could determine how Libya fares down the road. Libyan authorities hope that up to 20,000 soldiers will be trained overseas. Today, 360 cadets began boot camp in Britain. Marine Olivezi caught up with the cadets in Tripoli just before they headed off to the UK.
We welcome you to the United Kingdom.
It's Monday afternoon at a military base outside of Tripoli. Lieutenant Colonel Mickey Stewart reads out an official welcome to the Libyan recruits.
Under the conditions of your visa, you'll be entitled to stay in the United Kingdom to complete a 24-week military training course.
It's half pep talk, half security and regulation briefing. At one point, he reminds Libyans they're going to the UK for military training only.
That means you can't go off and work in the local garage.
Stuart is here with a dozen British officers and officials. They've got boxes, lists and uniforms for the 360 trainees. On stage, it's all organised, tidy and formal. In the audience, not so much. Cell phones go off, the men chatter away. Like others in the crowd, Taysir Alhamdani, my translator, is amused and baffled. Many of the cadets here are former rebel fighters, the same guys who became notorious during the revolution for their brazen courage and very little discipline. Taysir wonders aloud how these men will ever be proper soldiers.
A rebel is a free man. Rebel, you're not under any law. You can do whatever you like. But in a military institution, when you do something out of the order, then you're kicked out. So I think it's hard for him to adjust to that, to be a regular soldier in an army. It's up for the Brits to show their abilities. If they're going to polish these guys into real soldiers.
The Libyan officers in the room wonder just the same, especially after the Turkey debacle. Nearly a third of the recruits sent there this winter gave up and went home before the end of the training. They complained about the weather, the early morning start, and the strenuous drills. Adel Akari, the senior army officer who is supervising the overseas program, says that won't happen again. This group went through a two-month tryout and a British background check. Akari says one challenge was to handpick recruits from all parts of Libya and across the wide spectrum of tribes and militias. He says that included Islamists, as long as they didn't have ties to any radical group.
Some of them, they have this ideology, but they're not under any group or any party related to extremists. And those people, if they can adapt or adjust to our laws, in the military, they're welcomed anyways, because we're not against people who's committed to their religion.
On top of the blacklist, Ansar al-Sharia, the al-Qaeda franchise that has gained ground in eastern Libya since 2012, their militants are widely believed to be behind the attack on the U.S. consulate in Benghazi that killed U.S. diplomat Christopher Stevens. Akari says keeping them out wasn't a problem. None of them wanted to join, quite the opposite actually. They did their best to derail the process. On March 17, a military graduation ceremony in Benghazi ended in bloodshed. Fawzi Mansour Abdallah, 27, who was also off to the UK, was there that day. We were walking outside of the gate when the bomb went off, he says. The guy sleeping next to me in the barracks was killed and a dozen others. But see, that's only reinforced my commitment. Where I'm from in eastern Libya, there's no military, no police, so you either join the terrorists or you join the army. I chose the army. Others say they've grown disillusioned with the militias that fought the revolution and are now clinging to power against Libya's best interest. Mickey Stewart, the lieutenant colonel who was trying to get their attention earlier, says behind their unruly demeanors, they're a highly motivated bunch.
They are only here as volunteers and very eager young men who will want to be a part of rebuilding the Libyan army and rebuilding the country post-revolution. And I think they're very much up for it. Young, fit, healthy blokes who are very keen to do it.
The next day, the recruits show up for their flights to England sporting brand new green uniforms with white belts. They definitely look more like soldiers than yesterday. British officers gather to send them off. They say a second batch should be ready to follow suit once this group is back in Libya in December. For now, the US Army is supposed to take over. The training will take place at a NATO base in Bulgaria. It was scheduled to start in July, but Libyan officers say not a single soldier has been recruited yet. For The World, I'm Marine Olivesi in Tripoli.
The deal to release one American soldier is still generating lots of discussion. I'm talking about Army Sergeant Bo Bergdahl, let go by his Taliban kidnappers in exchange for the U.S. releasing five Taliban detainees from Guantanamo. That raised a debate. Was a swap a smart move, or does it put more American lives at risk? And there's another subject of debate that caught my attention, Bergdahl's beard. He was clean-shaven when he was released, but Bergdahl grew a long beard while in captivity. And his dad sported one, too, last week at the White House. Those beards have a lot of people in Washington questioning Bergdahl's sympathies. Ziv Eisenberg has actually done research on the historical stigma of beards. He's a professor of history at Yale.
Well, there's a long history of politicizing and stigmatizing masculine beards. And the rage that we see today in some conservative circles about Bergdahl's beard actually echoes earlier chapters in American political history when certain individuals and political groups were stigmatized and their opponents used the beard as a symbol to identify those groups. Mm. And I'm talking particularly about left-wing radical politicians and activists, communists, socialists, anarchists in the early 20th century.
So Abraham Lincoln had a beard, but we're not going back that far, and he had a good beard, if you go by historical records. When did beards start to represent something less virtuous than Lincoln?
Well, actually, Lincoln was the first president to have a beard, and his physical appearance corresponded with the rise of the beard as a new masculine fashion. If you look at the list of American presidents, they actually their physical appearance actually reflected this new trend in the second half of the 19th century to have a beard. However, in the late 19th century, scientists, primarily in Europe, formulated the germ theory of disease. And this theory, which was accepted by the medical establishment by the early 20th century, was popularized in the early 20th century. And although doctors and scientists were able to identify bacteria that was causing disease, their therapeutic arsenal was mostly limited. We didn't have antibiotics until the 1930s and 1940s. So what doctors and public health officers emphasized in the early 20th century in light of this new revolutionary theory, the germ theory of disease, was that people of all walks of life adopt new bodily regimens. Beards, facial hair was considered filthy. It was feared that it might harbor deadly infectious bacteria. So men were told to discard their beards.
Wow, that is fascinating stuff. I mean, that sense that beards had germs in them, how did society kind of fold that knowledge into their political perception of people with beards?
Well, it's interesting that at the same time that Americans were learning how to accept this new threat of infectious disease and thinking about it and trying to prevent it, they were also facing a new political opponent in the form of left-wing radicalism. And when the Bolsheviks seized Russia in 1917, they promised that they're going to spread the revolution to the rest of the world. And there was a new public discussion in the United States about whether the U.S. might fall into communism, too. However, how do you know that someone is a communist? The Justice Department was looking for subversive organization. They were looking for communist activists, but you don't necessarily know what's going on inside a person's head. And this is how beards became to symbolize, in popular imagination, people who were suspected as being left-wing radicals. And it's very similar to the way some conservatives today, think about the risk that they conflate with Muslims and terrorism and threat to the demographic makeup of the United States in the 21st century. So how do you know if a person is a Muslim or if a person is a terrorist? You don't necessarily know, and this is how beards actually come to symbolize today a certain threat. You know, Bill O'Reilly said on the show on Fox News that Bo Bergdahl's father is a Muslim because he looks like a Muslim.
Well, what do you think, Ziv, when you see kids these days in their 20s, you know, kind of trendsetting with beards?
I feel for them as someone who, like you, doesn't like shaving, but at the same time, very similar to the sentiment you expressed in the beginning of our conversation. After 3 or 4 days, I get tired and itchy.
Ziv Eisenberg is a professor of history at Yale University. And just for the record, I did ask him, he does not have a beard. And tomorrow, kickoff, the World Cup starts in Brazil. The specter of protests and labor strikes continues to hang over the tournament, though. The unrest is getting widespread media coverage in Brazil, but not the right kind of coverage, according to a group of ninjas. They actually call themselves media ninjas, and they're citizen journalists covering the social unrest with their smartphones and sometimes scooping the mainstream reporters. Jerry Haddon has our story from Rio de Janeiro.
Media ninjas' headquarters looks like a college apartment. A bunch of guys lounging around with laptops, dirty dishes in the sink, post-it notes about shared responsibilities on a wall. Except these notes aren't about taking out the trash. They're about covering the biggest protest movement Brazil has seen in 2 decades. Felipe Marquez, one of the volunteer collective's leaders, stands by a chart of Brazil's new soccer stadiums. This is the schedule for the World Cup games in Rio and elsewhere, he says. We'll get word out to everyone via Twitter about alternative events, protests happening in front of the stadiums themselves. Ever since the eruption of protests in 2013, he says, we're trying to build a new reality that addresses the underlying problems. The list of problems includes poor health care and education. So why then, protesters ask, did we spend about $15 billion on soccer stadiums? The protests all began last summer over a 10-cent hike in bus fares in the capital, Sao Paulo. Hundreds of thousands of mainly poor people piled into the streets. Police responded with beatings, pepper spray, and bullets. Media ninjas captured a lot of it, live streaming images like this one of police chasing down a female protester and beating and kicking her. Such footage infuriated Brazil's middle class, who joined the protesters in cities across the country. Felipe Marques proudly shows the smashed screen on his smartphone, his main broadcasting tool. It's the result, he says, of a police stun grenade. Until Media Ninja, he says, you didn't see a lot of images like this police beating on the news. He says, in Brazil, we have a media model that is very monopolized. The news outlets are in the hands of a small number of families, and now there's a huge gap between the reality that these media outlets describe and what people actually live. People feel invisible, he says, to the mainstream media, or criminalized. Media Ninja, Marques says, is giving them a voice. The ninjas now have hundreds of thousands of followers on social media. They help scoop the mainstream press at one protest, compiling footage of what appears to be an undercover policeman inciting violent clashes with authorities, who are now investigating. But is this really journalism? Longtime reporter Fernando Molica isn't sure. He works at the daily newspaper O Dia in Rio. He says the democratization of the media is a good thing. The more voices, the better. But what's much more complicated is that these groups are violent against traditional journalists. Molica says groups like Media Ninja are so against traditional outlets that they, quote, out mainstream reporters at events. Crowds then surround them, as in this incident this year, chanting for them to leave. Molica says you can't just demand a voice in the media scene and then try to silence everyone else. That, he says, smacks of biased activism. Media Ninja's tactics are under fire from another sector, Brazil's military police, whose members have often been caught by the ninjas using excessive force. On a recent day, military police commander Eduardo Carlos patrols a favela near downtown, flanked by heavily armed men. Police have been trying to, quote, pacify these crime-ridden neighborhoods since Brazil won World Cup hosting rights in 2007.
So when you patrol in a place like this, you have to have eyes in the back of your head.
Yes, of course.
Alley this way and alley that way, behind you, yes. Rooftops, yeah. Below, rooftops, above.
The windows and all this.
Carlos says at night it's especially difficult to distinguish between the enemy and innocents, including new rogue reporters like the Media Ninjas, who don't wear press badges or vests. He says the truth is that, yes, it can complicate things when a lot of people are running around. Although generally during demonstrations or in fights with drug traffickers, the press tends to stand behind the police. That's not the ninja style. They say the larger truth is that the powers that be just don't want new media around, embarrassing and exposing them. So their work goes on, giving voice and gathering new supporters, like at this rally on Ipanema Beach to legalize marijuana. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Rio de Janeiro.
By the way, you can find all our coverage of the World Cup and soccer at PRI.org/World Cup. This is The World on PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity.com, personalized brain training programs developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving through games. More at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're all still absorbing the political shockwaves today after last night's stunning primary results in Virginia. Congressman Eric Cantor, the GOP's majority leader in the House, was soundly defeated by college professor Dave Brat, a Tea Party favorite. And here's why we at The World are interested in this development. Washington pundits are going wild dissecting the unexpected result, and one of the factors they're citing is Cantor's stance on immigration reform. Here's a clip from a Cantor appearance on Fox News last year.
If a kid was brought here by his parents or her parents, unbeknownst to them, and know no other place than home, than America's home, why wouldn't we want to give them a path to citizenship?
Cantor's critics say that amounts to an amnesty for lawbreakers. I've got Ben Monterosso on the line. He's executive director of Mi Familia Vota, a grassroots organization that advocates for comprehensive immigration reform. First of all, Ben, how big a factor do you think immigration reform was in Eric Cantor's loss last night?
I think that the issue of immigration did play an issue to help the guy who won the election, but I think he won the election because Mr. Cantor was not paying attention to his constituency. And let's make one thing very clear. Mr. Cantor was never been any favor to immigration reform. He played both sides of the issue, and he stopped the debate in the Congress. So I just feel that when you have committed people like Lindsey Graham who stood by his decision and explained to the voters, you can see that you can win elections with that issue.
Right. Well, it does leave us with the question, whether immigration reform now? I mean, many Washington insiders are saying that the chances of immigration reform were already on life support. And last night's election in Virginia pulled the plug. How do you feel?
The only ones that can pull the plug, the Republicans, 66,000, which is the number of voters in a conservative area in Virginia who decided the election, should not define whether or not the issue of immigration is dead.
Yeah, I'm wondering how much the 66,000 voters are going to have influence on other candidates. Are you worried that other candidates, especially Republicans who support, you know, DREAM Act kind of things, to reevaluate their positions or else they'll become another Cantor?
Well, I think that either you have a choice here. Either you be afraid of the Tea Party or you'll be concerned about your constituency and the areas that you represent that is growing. And we know that there's a lot of Congress people that their districts are not looking the same as Virginia.
Ben, for your activists who are out there on the ground with clipboards and speaking to people, how do you keep them motivated after something like what happened last night in Virginia?
The same way that we've been keeping them motivated for the last 20 years. Just keep in mind that this issue of immigration reform over the last 8 months has been declared dead by a lot of different people, by political pundits, by media, by the Republican Party, and we're still here. Failure to fix immigration reform is not an option because 11 million people live in this country and are being separated. So that is the motivation. We're definitely going to continue doing that. And one thing that you're going to start seeing more and more, our community not only register, but start participating a lot more in the elections. The same thing that happened in 2012 is a big surprise for the Republicans who didn't know how to get to our community. They find out that our community went out to vote for the candidate that they felt that was going to represent our issues.
Ben Monterosso with the activist organization Mi Familia Vota, speaking with us from Washington. Thank you, Ben.
Thank you very much.
Speaking of immigration, our Global Nation desk has a blog post up right now at PRI.org. It features some great photos by Encarni Pindado. Her most recent work is a project called Migra Zoom. She's given migrants who are making the trek to the U.S. border disposable cameras, and you can see the journey north through the migrants' own eyes. Again, those incredible photos are on our website, PRI.org. Finally today, and just in time for tomorrow's World Cup opener, I have a couple of questions I want to ask my soccer-mad colleagues William Troop and Patrick Cox. We'll start with Patrick, who's the world's language editor. I asked him why we Americans call it soccer while everyone else around the globe calls it football.
This is funny because it actually started in England. 1863 is when a group of people met. There were two versions of football taking place at the time: rugby football and what became known as association football, which is soccer today. Now, the SOC and association then became, over time, soccer. It really only became known as soccer in countries that had another game called football, gotcha. Like this country, like in Ireland, like in Australia, Canada, But back in England, nobody really needed to call it soccer because there was only one football. Rugby was called rugby. Football was called football.
So what do the English think today of the word soccer? Is it just kind of indignance?
There's a little bit of kind of contemptuous, that's what the Americans call it. But that's a rewriting of history.
Another linguistic thing I want to ask, William, fans like to call soccer the beautiful game. Where did that come from?
Well, actually, that might be another example of something that the Brits might have started, but they lost control of it. There's some reference to a couple of British commentators or writers having used the phrase sometime in the past of the game, but nobody else really used that until a certain guy by the name of Pelé used it in the title of his autobiography. And this was after Pelé came here to the U.S. to play soccer with the Cosmos, people might remember. He came out with his autobiography and called it My Life and the Beautiful Game. It is from that point on that people have called it not just the beautiful game, the phrase in English, but also the phrase in Portuguese, Jogo Bonito, is how you might just say in one phrase how people aspire to play good soccer these days.
How people aspire to play Brazilian soccer, you might say.
Well, if they manage to play it, they might win.
Patrick, I know you're kind of in love with an Ivory Coast player who has actually lent himself to a musical phrase now.
I'm just this much away from being in love with him, let's say. His name is Didier Drogba. He's now 36 years old. So this is going to be his last World Cup when he plays for Ivory Coast. And in 2006, if you remember, there was a civil war taking place in Ivory Coast at the time. Didier Drogba, who was a massive star at the time, made a big speech that a lot of people believe helped end that civil war. And as a result of that, his cult status just rose through the ceiling all across West Africa. And this term arose. It is drogbacité. Drogbacity, the state of being Drogba. It's the spirit of being positive, of skillful, of having great timing. So it very much refers to both soccer and events off the field. And there was, of course, a dance, a Drogbacité dance that went with this sort of good feeling.
Well, the world's Patrick Cox and William Troop, you have both demonstrated incredible drogbacité today. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Marco. I'm touched.
I'll try and do the dance now.
Keep dancing. We have a lot more on the language of soccer and the World Cup in Patrick's podcast, The World in Words. You can find that at pri.org/language. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH, I'm Marco Werman. Back with you tomorrow here on The World.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH, supported by the Rita Allen Foundation, investing in transformative ideas in their earliest stages to leverage their growth and promote breakthrough solutions to significant problems. RitaAllen.org. By PRI's New Voices Fund, whose donors include Maureen and Michael Rutgers and the Sarah and Evan Williams Foundation. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world, macfound.org. The PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Peter and Catherine Darrow, the Gruber Family Foundation, Marguerite Steed Hoffman, Ken and Lucy Lehman, and the Robbins Kaplan Miller Cerisi Foundation. And by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, supporting innovations in education, democratic engagement, and strengthening international peace and security at carnegie.org.
PRI. Public Radio International.